KVOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to the Coalition Black Trade Unionist segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a member of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees Retirees Union and the president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists here in Oregon. Tonight, I'm joined by my sister in the struggle.
Hi, I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell. I'm the vice president of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unions. I'm a retired from the United Auto Workers staff in Detroit and president and CEO of the Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute.
So tonight our guest is Graham Traynor, who's the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Tonight, we're going to be discussing the devastating impact of the coronavirus. Welcome to our show, Brother Traynor.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to chat.
Okay, so let's get right to it. Given the worldwide familiarity with the coronavirus, can you share with us, with our listeners, your most poignant view that you've developed about this disease since its impact up until now?
That's a great question, Tina. And, you know, the thing that I continue to lose sleep over and think about every morning when I wake up is just how difficult a time this is for working people in this country and in this state. You know, we have a global pandemic and an economic collapse that workers are dealing from, and, you know, workers' lives have been turned upside down by whether it's a layoff or really having to risk exposure to the virus as an essential employee showing up to work. And so those are the things that keep me grounded every day in the midst of this crisis. But the thing that I also remember and remind folks every chance I get is that, you know, the economic system that we've been working within hasn't been working for most of us for a really long time. It's easy to sort of lose sight of that or forget the economic inequality and the record-breaking gaps between rich and rich, rich and everyone else before this crisis took hold. But but that's the reality. You know, the economic system is leaving far too many people behind, especially women and workers of color. Economic inequality was truly reaching levels unseen since the Great Depression, just a few months ago, before this coronavirus pandemic really again became the focus of our attention. So what I continue to think a lot about and plan around is the fact that this crisis has really just exacerbated the problems that already existed in our economic system. So when we think about our policy work and our agenda moving forward, we have to keep that in mind that class was very an economic system that wasn't working, and now it's just gotten worse. And so, so that's something that I think a lot about. I know folks in the labor movement that are really on the front lines of this fight to protect workers, whether they're essential workers, and again, risking exposure every day when they go to work, or they're folks that have been, their lives have economically been turned upside down by a sudden layoff. Some industries we've seen almost 100% unemployment in a specific industry. With those things in mind, it's really important that we do thoughtful planning around what the recovery is going to look like. So I'll stop there, but lots of things going through our minds in the labor movement, and I know I'm really proud of the work that the labor movement's done. You know, really being, as always, the last line of defense for the working class, and this crisis is really, I think, putting that on display every day.
Okay. I understand the National AFL-CIO has 6 priorities of the labor movement to address the coronavirus. How does the Oregon AFL address these, and how can we build on the list?
Also a good question. Let me just remind listeners about those principles that the National AFL-CIO has developed. One, protect frontline workers. That's a must, to protect the workers that are on the front lines today. Two, we must mitigate the broader public health crisis, making sure that guaranteeing 14 days of paid sick leave for all working people, and the list goes on. Three, we must sustain people through the crisis. That's reimagining the unemployment insurance system, which is, you know, in the process of being done, but it's still having its hiccups. That includes, you know, what about healthcare and COBRA coverage, and thinking about workers that need benefits even when they're unemployed. So that benefit continuity question. Number four, we must sustain workers in severely affected sectors. So whether it's airlines, transportation, construction, retail, manufacturing, entertainment, hospitality, those are some of the hardest hit industries, and we've got to make sure that we're thoughtful about sustaining those workers in those really impacted industries. Number five, we must sustain state and local governments. This is really critical. Unfortunately, the Senate Majority Leader made an inference the other day on the Senate floor that we should let states go bankrupt. And that is the most ridiculous thing I've heard in at least the last week. But again, it reinforces the need for that fifth point. And number six, rebuilding the economy and putting people back to work. So those are the six principles that the National AFL-CIO has come out with as it relates to dealing with the coronavirus. And there's no question that the AFL-CIO lifts up that same agenda. And we're thinking a lot about what the state responsibilities and the state responsibility really is as well. So the AFL-CIO, our labor partners, and our progressive worker advocates have come together to put together policy recommendations that have been submitted to the legislative committee that was created, a special committee on the coronavirus. AFL-CIO and our labor partners are engaging with the governor's office and the economic advisory council that she has created as it relates to the coronavirus's impact on our economy. We continue to really work at all levels, at the state level, at the local level, with state agencies, with policymakers, with the governor's office, and the list goes on, to ensure that there is an Oregon response that meets the needs of Oregon workers. And so, again, I would just say that with the national's priorities to address the coronavirus, the Oregon version of that is very similar, and it's just very localized. And so we're hard at work every day, along with other partners in the state, to ensure that working people have a seat at the table. And I got to tell you, like I said earlier, it's been really, I take a lot of pride in seeing the role that the labor movement, the organized labor movement in Oregon, is playing in every one of these arenas. Really being the only line of defense for workers, and that every single day, every single meeting I'm in, is just so on display that the labor movement, unions, worker advocates are all really the only ones speaking up for workers when the business community has all the money, all the resources to have lots of voices at the table. You know, the organized labor movement really is the working class voice.
So I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase that all politics are local. Would it be more prudent for the Oregon labor movement to pursue the challenges ahead of us through legislation or through contract negotiations?
Great question. I kind of alluded to that earlier in my earlier response. Absolutely is my answer. There's a federal strategy at play, and there must be state strategies. You know, one thing I'll just say is that we have really seen a big difference between states with progressive pro-worker leaders and those that are less pro-worker, in the way that they've handled their responses to the coronavirus and the seriousness that they've taken. And so when I think about the West Coast governors that have acted really boldly and decisively around, statewide stay-at-home order that was meant to bend the curve of the coronavirus, that is starting to work. We're seeing it starting to work. We're not out of the woods yet, but it is working in all three West Coast states, and so I'm proud of that. Absolutely, whether it's with policymakers or with employers, we've also seen some really good examples of Oregon unions sitting down at the table with employers and, you know, have a shared sort of fate in this crisis moment, to gain, you know, a better understanding of letters of agreement and memorandums of understanding that really spell out the worker concerns as it relates to the coronavirus and sort of the things that even have shown up in the contract, in the collective bargaining agreement. So I think it's an any and all, you know, of those elements strategy you must take to really to put workers again at the center of this conversation. And proud of the work, we clearly haven't done enough, and we're going to never, any day throughout this crisis, are we going to rest on our laurels. But I am proud of some of the progress we've been able to make on those fronts.
Okay. So it's my impression that the coronavirus has constructively laid out the inequalities of service workers, such as grocery workers, bus drivers, cab drivers, janitors, and transit workers. How can labor do a better job to better equalize the value of their work versus the value of the first responders?
That's also a good question. Something that really has been on my mind a lot lately, you know, the thing that has absolutely driven me nuts is that the folks that are on the front lines, whether they're healthcare workers, first responders, or frankly, grocery workers, transit workers, the folks that you rattled off, these folks have always been heroes and have incredible dignity and value in their work, in our book, in the land of it. And it took a global pandemic and economic collapse to remind the rest of society about that value and dignity. And so that's a frustration that I have, but in my mind, it's also an important evolution in society's consciousness about the value and dignity of all work. And so so we have been doing everything we can to lift up that value and dignity. And we have always known, but society is just starting to kind of wake up to. And frankly, I've talked to a lot of grocery workers, I've talked to a lot of transportation workers and transit workers, I've talked to a lot of these frontline folks, and they don't necessarily see themselves as heroes. They don't think of themselves as everyday heroes when they go to work. They're just showing up to do the service that they signed up for as a job or as a career or as a passion. And what they really want is to be treated by their employer like heroes. And so in some cases, we've seen examples of that, where employers have stepped up to the plate, they've given special sort of COVID or hazard pay, as being called, because of those workers, the exposure, the under, hardship and exposure that they face when they go to work, given the circumstances and given this pandemic. But too many employers are treating these workers like the everyday heroes that society likes to suggest they are. And so I think it's up to the labor movement to, one, remind employers that the value and dignity of this work and the importance of that, again, the everyday heroes that these folks are purported to be when it comes to negotiating over economic issues at the bargaining table. It's also our job to remind elected leaders about this, because just like corporate world forgets the value of frontline essential workers when it's not a time of crisis, so do elected leaders if we don't remind them. So it's really important that we kind of keep that on the consciousness, and the labor movement is going to be working on a strategy to do just that.
Okay. Well, I'd like to remind our listeners, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. Tonight, our guest is Graham Traynor. He's the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
I'd just like to say thank you. This is Audrey. I want to thank you, President, for all the work you do and the commitment and the enthusiasm. As being a retiree for 40 plus years, the work still continues. So when you see the commitment from individuals, especially in the leadership position, really want to thank you for continuing the work. Governor Brown has issued a sequester on non-essential workers to remain at home and is currently working on a release plan. What should that plan include to safeguard against the continued expansion of this disease?
That's a really good question, Audrey, and thanks for those kind words. I appreciate learning from longtime trade genius like yourself, so appreciate the partnership. You know, the thing that I think a lot about when it comes to reopening the economy, these conversations that have started to take hold, you know, we must do this in a really thoughtful, science-based, public health-focused way. Workers are not bargaining chips as it relates to reopening the economy. And so we shouldn't be in a situation where workers are put in an unfortunate situation where they're forced to go to work before they feel comfortable doing so, before they feel like they're safe and healthy to do so. And so, so in order to ensure that those voices are in the mix, you know, we have kind of been beating the drum with the governor and elected leaders about the importance of working people being at the table for any conversations as it relates to reopening the economy. I would say, there have been worker voices in the mix as these conversations have been happening. I'm in the governor's economic advisory council around the coronavirus response, as are four other labor partners, alongside five business leaders, and then a number of state agency heads. And so that council is a place to keep worker voices and worker perspectives kind of on the forefront of the governor's, the governor's office's mind. If we don't have the proper personal protective equipment for workers in these industries, it's futile to think that we can actually safely reopen the economy. If we don't have rapidly available testing around the coronavirus, it's futile to think that we can just quickly reopen the economy. If we don't have the ability to trace the contacts of the people that are exposed to the coronavirus in a really rapid way, again, it's futile to reopen the economy in a really hasty way. And so, so we're encouraging folks to take that public health focused approach when we start conversations around the reopening. And there's no one. There's probably no one in the state that wants to get back to work and to equalize the economy and get workers back in their jobs more than the organized labor movement. And yet, we're not going to sacrifice worker safety and sort of the basics of safety in the job for that goal. And so, I think yesterday was Workers' Memorial Day, the day that we stopped honor the workers that have fallen on a job, whether it was a death or a significant injury, there were still more than 60 workers that died on the job as it relates to an occupational accident or illness last year in 2019. And if this pandemic hasn't further exposed the safety and health risks that workers face on the job, I don't know what does. And so another thing that I think about, the National has been talking a lot about this, the National Labor Movement, as it relates to an infectious disease standard for all employers around the country. When the Trump administration came into office, the Obama administration had instituted an infectious disease standard that gave a national standard for all employers on what to do in the event of an infectious disease. The Trump administration undid that as soon as they got into office. And so not only has their response been inadequate, it's also been made worse because of the actions and the carelessness as it relates to the Trump administration's work within the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, where there are fewer inspectors today, inspectors that make sure that workplaces are safe for workers, there are fewer inspectors today than at any time in history at the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So, again, lots of responses and thoughts about
yes.
that, but at the end of the day, we must keep a safety, worker-centered approach when we think about reopening the economy and not get hasty about it. That could ultimately backfire and we see another spread.
President Graham, this particular question, I'm very sensitive to this one. It says, some members of Congress have identified two vulnerable groups who have suffered the greatest throughout the course of this disease, the elderly, particularly those living in long-term care facilities, and people of color, and one of which is my sister, who just got diagnosed, who works in a facility like that. She got diagnosed yesterday. Would you urge Governor Brown to develop a commission to review these facts and recommend some policy changes to reduce this outcome?
First of all, I'm sorry to hear that about your sister. Second, you know, to answer your question, I'll say that the governor and our public health agencies, like the Oregon Health Authority, have really been doing good work in the midst of some of the most challenging circumstances to take a public health centered approach, like I mentioned earlier, to this state's response. But there is no question that this crisis, these types of crises, highlight even further the inequities in our communities, whether it's access to care, economic stability. I mentioned this, I think, to you all when we were talking offline, but I know that the Urban League has been doing really good work, important work, to gain access to the data about testing, access to care, to better understand those impacts on especially the Black community, but all Oregonians, especially those that suffer disproportionate impacts from these types of crises. So there's no question that there's no work to be done to ensure that the diverse voices from our communities are included as we come together to rebuild a more inclusive Oregon. And I know the Labor Movement, I'll just speak for our organization, Labor Movement, we are absolutely committed to lifting up disproportionately impacted voices. A couple of examples of that more recently are the Oregon Worker Relief Fund, which was a fund and an effort to provide some economic stability and stimulus to those workers that are falling through the cracks of our current safety net, like undocumented workers, immigrants, workers of color. And so we were really proud to see just last week the Oregon Legislature's emergency board did fund, even though we're not in session, they came together in an emergency board meeting and did fund an initial stimulus for that program, focused again at those disproportionately impacted workers that are falling through the cracks of the system that we have today, like unemployment insurance. And so we were a sponsor and an advocate in that meeting. We were talking to legislative leaders about that in any effort to, again, equalize and sort of provide equity as it relates to the disproportionately impacted communities. In a crisis like this, the labor movement is down and game. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for all you do, President. You seem like we've got a lot on our hands to do. Mm-hmm. In our closing, the Coalition of Black Trade Unions continues to meet the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. And since the coronavirus, we have suspended face-to-face meetings and are utilizing Google Hangouts to conduct our meetings. So our next meeting will be held on May the 12th. And our email address is orcbtu10@gmail.com. And we would love to hear from you all. So join us in our evolving adventure of representing Black union and workers. Thank you, President Graham.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and keep up the good work. You all are fighters for justice.
So before we sign off entirely, I talked to you a little earlier, and you were talking about trends in regards to the coronavirus and some of the work that's being done nationally. Do you want to give our listeners a rundown of what some of those trends are as far as worker-employer trends?
Sure. In terms of some of the things that we're seeing, it's unfortunate we just saw yesterday a really careless, half-baked executive order by this administration trying to ensure that the meat supply chain was all deemed essential and required to stay open despite some of these outbreaks and really dangerous working conditions for workers in places around the country. So the National Labor Movement is calling out that executive that really careless executive order that was just issued yesterday. That's a really just recent example, because we believe it is an executive power to force people back on the job without proper protections is wrong and dangerous, and we must put worker safety first. So I think that's one recent example. I could say a lot of things about that question, but one of the things that we know is that there are, like I mentioned earlier, there are some industries that have been completely shut down where workers are almost, if not 100%, laid off. And so these workers, whether they're in the entertainment industry, the hospitality industry, looking at the airports where obviously traveler frequency is far, far down, These are all workers, and we must keep in mind when we think about a recovery. I know the congressional action has attempted to address some of these really, really hard-hit industries and the workers in them, but again, so much more is needed. We're proud to have some really strong worker advocates in our congressional delegation. We just hosted Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici on a call that we did with Oregon Union leaders on Monday. We have hosted Senator Merkley, who's been on the front lines, as well as our other Democratic members of the congressional delegation in Oregon. These folks have really been champions for workers, standing up on the right side of this issue, the right side of justice, and we're really proud of that and want to continue to do advocacy at the federal level and also remind Oregon leaders that we must do more as well.
Wonderful. Again, I'd like to join Sister Audrey in thanking you for all the work that you do. This coronavirus, it wasn't something that anybody expected. And again, it's turning out to be quite a challenge in order to provide a safe work environment for our union brothers and sisters. And so once again, thank you very much for all of the work that you do. And we look forward to talking to you again in the future when some significant changes have been made.
Great. Thanks so much. Stay safe, stay healthy. Keep up the fight.
Okay. Well, holla.
Okay.
Holla.
I'm Doug McVeigh from the Prison Pipeline Collective. KBOO is not holding its annual spring pledge drive this month, yet we still need your support, so please go to the KBOO website right now at kboo.fm, click on the Donate Now button, and make your pledge. KBOO is a vital part of your life and of the community, amplifying the voices of people who are often underrepresented. KBOO informs, educates, and entertains. Your support makes all that possible. Please go to kboo.fm, click on the Donate Now button, and make your pledge. Thanks for your support.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The organization Penal Reform International recently released its report, Global Prison Trends 2020. With a summary of its report, here's PRI's Director of Policy and International Advocacy, Olivia Rope.
I want to start by echoing what the Assistant Secretary General and Dr. Kitty Pong mentioned around, you know, there's no doubt that prisons and justice systems are facing an overwhelming crisis today with coronavirus. And only with, you know, bold, coordinated international action do we think there is a chance to mitigate, not prevent, but mitigate the damage of this virus in prisons. However, as has been mentioned, you know, COVID-19 has really just lit the fuse on the ticking time bomb that is present in our criminal justice systems. So for instance, today in our report, you will read that rates of deaths in prisons are at crisis levels. The mortality rate for people in custody is as much as 50% higher than for people outside, and this means that your life is literally at greater risk when detained. Violence in places of detention is on the increase, with crisis responses triggering the use of riot squads, for example, which often turn out to be fatal. Or conversely, the authorities' blindness to systematic violence, to torture, ill treatment, which is a human rights crisis, and we document this in some detail in our report. And lastly, as mentioned, the simply, you know, crisis levels of overcrowding. As the Assistant Secretary General stated, prisons in over 100 countries operate above occupancy level, above their occupancy rates, and 22 operate above 200% of occupancy rates. So the spread of COVID-19 in such facilities is in effect a death sentence, and we have already seen some cases of this occurring.